thank you very much for coming to what is the fifth gathering of Enemies of Good Art. And we're very lucky to have this space. I didn't realise until recently that we could use this space as a public meeting space and to show films of our choice. And our choice today, considering what our movement is about, we thought we'd show work that very much deals with strong feminist issues, or issues that predominantly concern women. I'm really delighted to see that we have a man in our audience today. And we have had some turn up at our meetings, but I think the discussion involves men and women in terms of art practice and how one continues after children enter our lives. So our choice of films today are short. We have three. We have a short film by the English director, Andrea Arnold. It's about 20 minutes long. It's quite provocative. And it should spur some discussion afterwards, I'm sure, or encourage some discussion. And then we have one of my favourites, and I know that Kat Phillips and I programmed today, Semiotics of the Kitchen by Martha Rossler. Oh, great. And then we finish off by a wonderful piece by a young artist called Ikua McMorris. She graduated from the Royal College in 2007, and her wonderful piece deals with all sorts of issues in a very quiet manner, I think. So we're going to play the work and then discuss it. And what I was thinking was we could play the first two films and then discuss it if we wish to do so, and then we'll show Ikua's piece. And Ikua's piece is an hour long. It's a quiet piece to begin with, and then it builds up slowly to a climax. So we can talk while it's playing. I've spoken to her about this, and she doesn't ever expect anyone to sit through an hour long, or to sit through it for the entire hour. But we can do as we wish. It's a Saturday, you know, early in the ICA, so if we fancy that, we can do that. And if we want to discuss what we've seen, we can. So, again, welcome to the ICA, and Kat is going to play the film in just a second. I have to say that there's a little concern about the edge of the platform that we're on, so our babies are our own concern, so if we could just, of course we will, we're mothers, make sure they don't crack their skulls open. The toilets are just through the reception, facing you as if you were leaving the building, and the buggies, I've just parked them along the side, which is fine. So kick your shoes off, and I hope you enjoy what we've managed to put together for this morning.
And what about Semiotics of the Kitchen? Did that resonate with anyone here?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah?
I guess that would be more of a, like, what a lot of people would call feminist film because it's got that cynical note to it. While the first one was just very touching, very moving. And so for me, neither. It wouldn't be roughly as a frightening feminist film, but I think, like,
the only mention in the adverts for sanitary towels.
Yeah, and you see a blue liquid being poured on them, or you see little puppies on toilet paper, so it's very removed from human liquids, actually. Mm. And this is actually how you feel as a woman. You really feel like
doing a poo.
Losing a lot of liquid.
Let's not look then.
I find it very strong, and my partner, my male partner, who he was around when Ikua sent through an excerpt of this film, just a preview, and he just saw it sort of flash up. I think I'd watched it already, so it was just stuck in a freeze frame as I skipped from on the laptop to something else. And he was like, oh, you've got new men, or something like this. So he actually read a very brief view of this image as a man, which I find quite interesting because one of the things that I find from this piece is she presents such a strong, grounded portrait of a woman, of the female body, say. She somehow managed to avoid all of the sexual, the normal sort of sexual undertoned images of nude women that we're so used to.
Not about sort of giant plastic breasts and kind of the kind of physical aspect is just straight.
It's about the
looking,
gaze, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really about. There's something about the kind of the way her shoulders are set. Yeah, something that I think that's the strength of it, and that is what makes it not be that kind of tits and corn and kind of that, you know, representation of the female body.
Yeah.
Yeah. I say more power to this kind of work by women because then. Oh, I watch you.
Jumps. Yeah, there's no apologies in it, which is nice. And the same as the semiotics kitchen. I love that piece. I mean, it's so of its time.
Yeah.
It's so fantastic. It, you know, it was part of a huge upsurge in feminist work at that time, which still speaks really strongly now. You know, it hasn't dated. It's fantastic.
Do you think so? I've got to say, I mean, do you know what year it was made? 75. I mean, I have to say, when I first watched it, I could appreciate. Because of its quality, you know, black and white and everything, I could tell immediately that it was from some time, maybe 30 years ago. And I could appreciate why it had been made,
yeah.
And I could appreciate its strength, but I couldn't relate to it, because I don't have this anger about the kitchen. You know, I don't have that as part of my identity. The things that I feel, the pressures I feel on my identity, that particular thing of being in an apron and doing the cooking isn't part of it for me anymore. So for me, it is dated.
Yeah,
but would most women agree with that here, that they don't feel in some way still changed the kitchen sink?
I'm not sure that's what the piece is about. It's not about being changed. It's about turning it around. That's what she's doing in that piece. She's completely throwing that on its face. And but I think for the vast majority of certainly heterosexual women in this country, most of them go home and cook their partners their dinner still. So, I mean, that might be different for us here, but I think that's still a reality.
I think for me, part of having Robin, who's now two, has been actually a discovery of food for me, because I was pretty rubbish at nurturing myself, and I certainly wasn't responsible for nurturing my partner in any way before I had a child. And now that I've got a child that's, you know, past breastfeeding stage, and I'm cooking for her, this is like a wonderful world that's opened up to me. So I suppose that my personal perspective is.
Did she love Martha Rosa? Yeah, Martha Rosa. Because I mean, it's interesting. I think that quite a lot of those feminists, like who we think of as kind of feminist artists from that period, significantly, some of them didn't have children. I mean,
please look.
Name's gone out.
What did she do?
The one who did the who made. Project, so quite a lot of community-based projects were getting people did. She worked with people doing like knitting did she lay all the table?
She didn't know how to work.
So maybe there were people from that generation who.
There was Mary Kelly's post-mortem document was here, wasn't it? She documented her childbearing, and that caused huge outrage.
guidelines.
The nappies.
Nappies of the ICA.
I think related to the second two, I think I'll give a agree, sorry, I don't know your name.
Okay.
I would agree with you because I personally, I didn't feel like I related as strongly as probably my mother would. And a few years ago, actually, did some short film with one of the things she was using. Because I had this strong view of my mother hammering the meat in such a, and that really stayed with me. And in spite of all, I don't know, I think most of what I felt was the fear of repeating my mother's relation to kitchen and family. And that was like a ghost that followed me. I wanted so much not to be trapped by that. And sometimes I would have conversations with my sister where we both felt the same way. We avoided so much sometimes to be nice to our partners just in case they got used to it. And sometimes we felt we were being horrible, actually, abusing a bit of the generosity, because they are very different from the image we had as a child of the male relationship with a woman. We are lucky enough, and I don't know, in a way, because my husband does take part in the kitchen environment, so I would say it was more the fear of falling that stayed with me.
I had those fears too, but I don't know if I avoided them entirely.
Well, not entirely, but I don't think it hit me as hard as did my mother's generation.
It's gone inside because it's finished, isn't it?
Even the feeding was like a part of the pleasing. If you did well, it was like you did a good job by pleasing your husband, by cooking really wonderful meals and things like that, And still when I'm serving some meal, I still feel sometimes this voice of
my mum used to take great pleasure in feeding her husband and preparing lovely meals and looking lovely for him. And I always saw it as a sign of weakness on her part that she would take so much pride and pleasure in keeping a lovely house and strive to keep the house as messy as possible at all times. I read recently that there's a new book out by a new cook, which is called How to Feed Your Man, and it's some sort of backlash to Nigella, where she styles herself very provocatively like Nigella, and it's all about how you get huge amounts of satisfaction from the cooking for your partner in the kitchen, specifically a man actually, not just a partner. And anyway, I read it and I was a bit disgusted by it. I just thought, have we not come anywhere in our feminism to go back to that, to go back to putting women in the kitchen? It seemed really weak.
The economic setup of so many relationships still seems to be an arrangement where the man earns the majority of the income.
Yeah, you inevitably find yourself driven into that position, even if you know. It is exactly. It's just the reality of economics that has remained.
Why is that the case? I mean, I'm sure there aren't many of us here who aren't degree standard educated.
Because we can bear children.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the only real reason that I can come up with that is the case. The fact that we can bear children, so we are the child bearers, we are the breastfeeders, and we do take time off work. And the workplace, right across the board, will not allow for that. It won't allow for us to have time off to have our children and then come back on an equal level.
So it's like there's that expectation of women. There's that expectation that women are going to go and do that. So it's like the workplace and you know, across the board, all different spheres expect them to do that. So it kind of doesn't even.
But there's nothing wrong with them expecting women to do that. But they seem to.
That's creating a negative working identity for women. And I don't really see why that needs to be a negative thing, you know?
Well, it's negative if a lot of women feel trapped by that,
isn't it? No. I mean the workplace holds a negative identity of women as workers.
Because it has that expectation of them being a
woman to have children.
So
that's why we get paid less. That's why we don't get the promotions that men get.
I'm going to disagree a bit. I'm not sure that is only related to income. Because again, in my own experience, like, I don't know, I'm coming from South America, and a lot of women work, and a lot of women even leave their children alone, and in many cases, the husband doesn't get as much money, but they still expect the wife to come back and feed and do all the stuff, even if she's the big earner. She's never seen. I've even said that before. My mother always worked, but I never saw her as independent at all. That never made her a feminist or independent woman. Actually, I very much saw the opposite. It was almost like serving the male rather than actually being free, you know, to do whatever she wanted to do.
Female work, I mean, you talk, this is women working right across all the classes. I mean, it's not just labourers, not just low income.
Yeah.
Is that a long history of it? So compared, say the UK, we could say pretty much that women became part of the general workforce after the World Wars. In the last century?
Right now?
Yes.
Okay.
I go to Nazareth.
I think that there is the women that stay at home, but even the women that stay at home, they always work somehow, either with selling goods, selling cakes, but there is always a participation from the women in the income. And of course, there are cases where the men I don't see a change in the relationship when they see the opposite at all. If anything, the way I saw was actually all this liberation that we call liberation. I just saw women being more and more oppressed by it because they would have to do 3 times more than the men, you know, and serve them and iron their shirts and leave their children in the weekends because they have to do all this extra stuff.
What if there's a possibility that women choose to do it because they do it better and they like to take control?
Yeah, I sometimes think about that. I sometimes, you know, because I don't know if it's just that I'm quite a controlling person or if it's just, you know, it's because I'm the woman in the equation that I do that.
If women can multitask better, if that's true, then maybe women choose to take on all the extra tasks because they can just do it more efficiently and be better at it. And then they know everything that's going on in all the factions so they can be queen of their domain.
But maybe we saw our mothers do it and therefore we've been conditioned.
Yeah. I think maybe we become control freakers because we feel this anxiety to provide and to do it, otherwise it won't be done. And then a lot of women end up thinking they have to cover all the roles, you know, everything has to be done, and they watch their mothers doing, then they feel the same, so you become quite compulsive to control in case everything fails and someone's dying.
Yeah, I
agree with the conditions of having the husbands or partners who saw their dads not do anything in the household, they have become conditioned as well. Maybe more so than the woman who's very much likely to change the situation.
I like that word.
The lady. You don't even have to go to Brazil to see that actually women who go back to work, they still find, in most cases, they still find themselves with most of the household work. Unfortunately, it hasn't changed very much. Maybe they don't iron shirts for their husbands anymore, or maybe he does one or two days of the cooking. But yeah,
that's your prime responsibility.
Yes.
I mean, I think the difficulty with domestic duties and childcare and nurturing a child is it's all about responsibility, and it seems to me that responsibility of you responsibility is a kind of strange force, and as soon as someone steps into the role of taking responsibility, whether it's to make sure that the food's in the freezer or in the store cupboard, or whether it's doing the washing up, as soon as someone steps into that role, it actually somehow pushes everyone else out of it. And I know certainly before I had a child, I would quite often, I might think about doing the shopping or think about doing the washing up, but then also suddenly think, actually, no, I've done it too many times this week already, I'm just gonna leave it. It would pile up, and then eventually my partner would explode, you know, and then explode into a frenzy of activity and do it all. But having had a child, I can't do that anymore. And so it's now had to become a discussion, which becomes like this nasty sort of, or potentially nasty argument that I suppose annoys me. Annoys me that we have to have the conversation. But I know that I've seen it happen. When I go home to my own mother's house, I don't want her to do all the cooking for us anymore. I'm a grown-up adult woman, you know, I know what that kind of pressure is. And she's very much a mother who always provided, did all of the everything. But it's very hard because she's much more forward-thinking than me. So it's very hard for me to actually get in there before she does it, and it's actually incredibly hard in a week visit to my mum's to actually take on my share of the responsibility. And I don't know if that, any of that makes any sort of conclusive sense, but
I think that point you made would make a very interesting social experiment, you know, because I always wanted, like I said, behave the opposite of what I saw wasn't quite a very good arrangement. But I had very long periods of illness where my husband took over my role as mother and, you know, everything else. I felt uncomfortable, but also you can get quite used to that, you know, of having someone taking over your work. And like you said about, I don't visit my mother because she doesn't live here, but my mother-in-law, she's that kind of person as well. She prepares everything in advance. She already cooks Christmas dinner in the freezer. And you get there and you get served. And I feel uncomfortable. And you just get into that role of being managed and served, and, you know. It's quite difficult to break from it, yeah.
It's also someone else's house or someone else's realm.
There is something of that going on between in domestic male-female relationships.
So I think that's the main problem now. When you find this person abroad, more or less, I think there's a condition of behavior, the past two generations, you know, that we kind of, in a way, put them in a role that's quite hard to break as well.
Well, I think until a man becomes... Sorry, guys.
In a position where they're the only ones responsible for a child's sake, they don't really get given the opportunity to learn, you know, or actually get into that part of themselves that, because I was very aware of beginning to dawn on me how much better everything can be if I plan ahead, you know, just meals and I don't know.
things, what I'm going to do that week with my baby. And but that was definitely a learning process for me. And if I hadn't been put in that situation, I would never have, I don't think I would have got there. You know, it wasn't like just something I could think up. It's the pressure, the real pressure on you that gives you the experience. And I think I think it's very complicated. How do you get both parents, how do they ever get to both have that real experience?
Yeah. I think it's very interesting, and I think the way that the pressure that women feel is very related, it's very cultural and social, a lot of cultural and social issues. And for instance, I'm French, and my partner is German, and we live in the UK. And as well, I think even if it's within Europe, you can already feel the different perception of like women being trapped, you know. And I think a British woman will have more pressure of being trapped than a French woman, because the social system would prefer her to be more, give her the opportunity to be more free in terms of, because the French system can allow you to have a child and without a gap in terms of income for a woman and going back to work, and then there is no gap in your CV, there is no gap, there is no difference in your lifestyle because you still earn the same amount of money.
But you have to go back to work after 3 months, don't you?
Yeah, but all the social system is there that you won't have to pay a lot of money for your childcare.
Okay.
And this kind of thing. And I think even as a male in UK, you can feel this pressure of having this kind of economic pressure to face that. And even, you know, I'm the one that earns the money, and I would be even more happy, you know. And I know that Misha is doing all the housework and she's cooking most of the time because I work longer hours and this kind of thing. But then I would prefer her to have like more freedom and being back to work. But then, because there is this kind of economic pressure, you know, it's I think that's why, you know, the two first movies are really interesting, because in the first one you can see that she's really left alone because she has no support, you know, she has no family. And then that's something as well cultural, you know, the place, you know, the importance of the role of family, you know, in society, or the role of the state in the family. I know, and she's really like left alone, she has no support. And that's interesting. And even the perception of being in a kitchen, I think that's something, that's another subject, but that's something very different in UK, in France, and in Germany. Because it is kind of inheritance of what your mum taught you, or what your dad taught you, as a boy or as a girl. But yeah, I mean, it's a very, I think, yeah, still a lot to do. And I think even if you, because feminism, you know, to me that started in the late 50s or I think even 50 years after that, you know, what would be the achievement? I'm sure there are a lot of achievements there, but you know, there is still a long way. But to me, yeah, it can't be achieved without the input of the state. I mean, that's something that...
It's really interesting, the idea that it's somewhat cultural. Do we think it's sort of like our frustrations are also possibly London-bound as well, that we are sort of trapped in this massive metropolis where there's no sense of... where there's no sense of sort of camaraderie or company or
you try Edinburgh
community.
Or somewhere else. Try somewhere smaller. The places to go, the places to meet with women outside of London are minuscule in their minds.
No, but I'm talking in terms of, you know, if we wanted to relieve each other of the, you know, of childcare financially that we could then form groups and support each other. Do you think that's inherently difficult to do in a city like London, or is it possible? Because I've been trying to do it for the last year and I haven't managed to pull it off yet. And Julie and I have done a lot of baby swapping, but that, you know, I had an idea that we might, as a group of women, you know, form networks where we could just help each other with childcare.
But isn't that more the problem that everyone has quite different circumstances? So, for example, like you found with me, I'm on an income that is low enough that it affords me the state support for childcare. So therefore, I don't need the group support of my fellow mothers.
Yeah, well, I don't believe for a minute I'm the only woman in London who can't afford childcare.
No.
And you know, there has to be.
It changes as they get a bit older. Then you're looking at they go to school, but then what do you do with that great long stretch of the holidays?
So
I think so. There are. It's about people's situation, like matching up with people who've got children of the same age, and who are geographically, you know, and just people that you start finding people that you get on with.
Considering the population of London is as big as it is, surely, you know, this keeps moving. So there's always, you know, a group of, you know, mothers at home with small children.
Yeah.
How do we tap into that?
You know, at the beginning, very first meeting, when you raised this issue, I've thought about that quite a lot, about because I live in East London. I imagine there's quite a lot of women who live in East London. The thing that puts me off is that I don't particularly want to end up doing a lot of childcare with a big group of kids. If I'm terribly honest.
So you prefer to pay for it?
So I have some local people and we do one to one.
Right.
I have and I have one woman who I do pay. Yeah. But I have a mixture of both. But I pay when I'm working. When I'm not working, I ask my friends to do it. So I don't have to pay. But I guess I did think about that idea because it was a very nice idea of the kind of shared studio space. I was really interested in that idea. And then I suddenly thought, oh my God, that's quite a lot of hard work looking after two or three babies.
Just for one day though?
Yeah, one day is quite a long time in my life. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but she's quite small.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still open to thinking about it as a real possibility in East London, though, because increasingly I've tried to make work with her in space, and it's impossible because it's getting more and more dangerous.
With Laurie, when he was tiny, I took him to the studio all the time from when he was about a month old until he was about 8 months.
Yeah.
And then once he got mobile, that was when it didn't work for me anymore.
It becomes dangerous.
Yeah, it just becomes dangerous and it just becomes that they're not prepared to be trapped in a pen in the corner, you know, and you can't really do that. And I ended up spending more time in the pen with him, keeping him entertained, than I did actually doing any work. So it was there was that bit at the beginning when it was possible, and then although now I have to say he's got a sofa and a TV and his books and his toys, and he loves coming to the studio.
Okay.
He comes there and he a while ago, it would have been a couple of months ago now, we got there, he said, put puppies on, you do some work. It was like he was telling me that I had to do, you know, it's because he knows that it's something that's important to me and that it keeps me cheerful, so he wants me to be cheerful. And it's like, just kind of, But then, I suppose that's a different thing again from then doing work to earn money. So, you know, I think increasingly, it's sort of becoming apparent to me that I really need to make sure that the work that I'm doing that earns money is also the work that I want to be doing.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult thing to put off. But, you know, it's getting there is hard. Sort of I think getting the balance right is very difficult. That's something that being in London probably does make hard because it's so expensive to live here. Grapes guy.
It's really lovely to see families here today. We've got two complete families.
That's nice. We're close to the weekend. Doing it on the weekend.
Yeah.
We should do some more weekend meetings.
Yeah, we should do. Yeah, we should do. We just happened to get this space, and today was the only day that we could arrange it for, so it worked out that we could do it for the weekend, which seems to be a nice time to meet. Do you think we get more men at meetings if we have more weekend meetings?
Definitely. Yeah, I think we would.
Yeah.
we should chat with
leave their kids with their partners, you know, there's, and then it's a different dynamic as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
the three of us who organised this today pretty much did, because we were restricted to a number of 30 seated in this particular construction.
Right.
So as not to take up space, we left our kids at home.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, little Cecily and Robin and Dexter would be causing as much audio entertainment as the rest of them. But our series of radio shows continues on Resonance FM on a Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock. And I hosted one yesterday where I talked with a screenwriter, a painter, and a photographer, and myself, and we talked about a lot of the issues that we're talking about today. But the next one, which comes up this Friday, Anna Shorter, with a video camera in front of you, is hosting that meeting, and it's very much about how artists choose to include or not to the subject of children in their work, either as a subject or as potential makers. And there's one amazing photographer from New York that she's managed to snare called Wendy Ewald, who's joining the show via radio link. So. Telephone. So it's turning into a for us it's a really interesting experience hosting them, but it's turning into a really interesting series of conversations where we're getting a lot of good response from academics, sociologists, psychoanalysts, practicing artists who want to be involved in the discussion. And the one on the 5th of November I'm hosting. It's called Big Society. And we have a sociologist, someone from the Tory think tank Res Publica, and a wonderful woman who runs Manifesto Club called Josie Appleton. So those are the next two coming up. And then we've another one coming up on feminism a little bit later on. And Jude Kelly, the director of the South Bank Centre, who's organising a massive festival called Women of the World in March. And she's joining us on that particular show. You wanted to...
I was just going to ask if there's any way we can access any archive of the...
Residents are going to host them as podcasts for us. And also we're going to host them on our website as well, Enemies of Good Art. So you'll find them in both locations.
Soon. We're working on it.
So...
when they're gonna
podcast them.
Yeah.
No, because they were at Freeze last week, so they've been a bit mental since then. So so we can ask them this week. But it's important so that they exist then on our website, because then they'll just exist for a long time as an archive that you can choose to listen to when it's convenient. And I think it's important to have that as a facility that's accessible and free.
Yeah.